vacation homes, as well as safe and unsafe areas. Get Prudent Places USA for only $29 plus shipping by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438.
Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and of course, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Joseph Smith. And Joseph Smith is a lawyer. He took his undergraduate work at Yale, and then, of course, he got his law degree. He works in Denver, where he served for some time as the assistant attorney general there, and now of course he is in law practice in Denver, Colorado. But he has written, along with his co-author, a fascinating book on George Washington. The title is Under God, and it really goes into the background of George Washington's beliefs. Now, we're told, oh, my goodness, you know, there's a wall of separation between church and state, but it's amazing that the wall of separation didn't exist for almost 200 years until 1940. They talked about it in 1962, I believe it was. They invoked this, and of course, my personal belief is this was an effort to destroy the Christian belief of the people of this country. And what happens when you take away the restraints that are put on the society? Why, it begins to fall apart. You have increased murder. You have increased crime. Well, you might even have 2.3 million people in our prisons today. In fact, indeed, if you look at this very carefully, why, one out of every 32 adult Americans is in prison, probation, or parole. We have more people in prison, probation, or parole than any other country in the world. In fact, far more than they have in brutal communist China, with, of course, almost four times our population. So this is what happens to a society when you take God out of it. And believe me, the Supreme Court justices, in my opinion, knew exactly what they were doing when they re-erected a wall of church separation between church and state, which didn't exist. Well, what our certainly Joseph Smith and his co-author have done is take the writings and the speeches of General Washington to get his opinion of what part religion would play in America. Joseph, thank you very much for being with us again.
It's a joy to be with you.
All right, fine. Joseph's been on our other two programs, but I thought it was so important I wanted this audience to hear it. So you tell us what motivated you to actually analyze George Washington's writings and speeches, and then what you found.
Well, being more or less a history buff and taking particular interest in the American founding, and I was also reading with somewhat of a lawyer's eye, I happened to be reading some of Washington's speeches. And for those who haven't, I really recommend it, and that, in fact, is the last half or so of our book, is just the primary materials, Washington in his own words. I was doing that, and they struck me as being extremely religious in nature. His first inaugural address, his second inaugural address, his farewell address, and the lesser-known speeches as well. And it's just, especially to the modern eye or the modern ear, I thought, boy, Washington really put God front and center in the public square. And boy, wouldn't the ACLU or some similar groups today be upset. So I was intrigued by it, and I really set out initially to read a book on the subject, and I couldn't find one. And so I decided and then recruited my co-author to write that book. As for what we found, Washington, of course, was the first president, and he was the president when the First Amendment, which includes the religion clauses, was enacted. So he's really an ideal exemplar of what it what the First Amendment means and the role of American government with respect to religion. And we found that Washington believed that government should not only accommodate, but actually promote religion. Almost always he spoke in non-denominational terms, and he did not want there to be a state religion. So he thought government needed to promote religion and accommodate religion, because he believed that a free people, in order to govern themselves...
All right, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming in from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Joseph Smith, who's a lawyer. He certainly worked as an assistant attorney general in the state of Colorado, and now he's in practice in Colorado. But he's written a fascinating book called Under God. And it's really all about George Washington and his religious beliefs. And, of course, what he said in his speeches, what he said in his writings about the importance of God for any sort of an orderly society, because he certainly, as the President of the United States, first in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen, believed that you could not have an orderly society, a military, certainly you had to have God there, and you had to have the restraints of a belief in a supernatural being, else, of course, things would really deteriorate into chaos. And he reiterates this over and over again. He even felt and he even wrote about the fact that he felt that God had certainly protected him when he was a soldier. And I'll even let you tell the story, would you, Joseph, about why George Washington believed that God had protected him?
Well, of course, I think in fairness, you know, we should probably assume it was a belief that accumulated over his entire lifetime, but a striking moment when he recorded that belief, and there were many times, but a really striking one, was during the French and Indian War when George Washington was a relatively young aide-de-camp. He was part of the British Army, and there was a terrible battle where the British, including Washington's, the forces that Washington was part of, were decimated by the French and Indians. And Washington wrote at the time to his brother, Augustine, and now I'll quote, Washington said, "I am still in the land of the living by the miraculous care of Providence that protected me beyond all expectation. I had 4 bullets through my coat and 2 horses shot out under me, yet escaped unhurt." And that was definitely one of the times, but by far not the only time, that Washington felt God was playing an active role in his life, and also he later came to say God was playing an active role in the creation of the American Republic. Firmly believed that God looked after the American army against the British, everything from storms coming up at just the right time to, you know, battles where the odds were very much against the Americans, somehow the Americans would prevail. Washington believed God had an active hand in that.
Well, I do, too, for that matter. But anyway, we'll be back here in just a moment with Joseph Smith talking about his book, Under God, and, of course, the views of our first president. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Joseph Smith. We're talking about his book, Under God. And of course, they've analyzed the speeches and the writings of George Washington. So you pick the story up there and tell us, certainly, your impression of George Washington's belief in the importance of God and public acknowledgement of God by our duly elected officials.
Well, you know, to the modern listener, I may have to remind people of a little bit of history. I certainly hope many of your listeners know George Washington pretty well, but unfortunately, much of the history about Washington is not really taught anymore. So for those who aren't so familiar, it's good to remember that George Washington wasn't just the first president. He wasn't just the commander of the army against the British. He spent nearly 4 decades in public service, and that started when he was in the colonial military, that is, the British military, where he became a commander and therefore had to think about how to run a portion of the military. He later served in the Virginia legislature when it was still a colonial legislature. Then he became commander-in-chief of the American Army and fought against the British and obviously had to run the entire Continental Army. Then he presided over the Constitutional Convention, all of the debates about what the Constitution should say and whether it should be ratified, balancing all the interests of the different states that had emerged. He was the one who presided over that convention, and then, of course, he became the first president and was reelected to a second term, so he served for a total of 8 years. Over that entire period, as I say, nearly four decades of public service, in each context, the record is very clear that he thought religion did play and should play an important role in civic life, going all the way back to his time, Washington's time in the colonial military. He had this letter-writing battle with the colonial governor of Virginia about the need for the government to pay for military chaplains so that the troops would have chaplains. And he got kind of put off by the colonial governor's refusal to pay that some of his own officers, some of Washington's officers, said, look, we will pay out of our own pockets for the military chaplains. We agree with you there should be chaplains, but we can pay out of our own pockets to hire them. And Washington said, no, this is part of government's job to make sure that there are chaplains in the military so that the men can attend daily divine service, which he commanded that they do. When he was in the Virginia legislature, they also paid legislative chaplains, and he voted for, right after the Boston Tea Party, in fact, voted for a day of public fasting and prayer, and then his diary on that day says he went to church. So he not only voted for it, he participated. And on, you know, on goes the story to the time when he's president of the United States, and perhaps the most interesting, really specific kind of example you can give of Washington when he was literally running the federal government as president are his is his issuance of two Thanksgiving proclamations that you know, were days of prayer for the United States and for the people of the United States to pray publicly. And one of those was issued before the First Amendment, then the First Amendment passed, and one was issued after the First Amendment. So it was clear that he did not think the First Amendment commanded some sort of strict separation between church and state, because his own approach to that issue in particular, but also more generally, did not change.
Well, I think it's so important that people understand what it was like in colonial America. Certainly, almost every state had its own religion, and I think 11 of the 13 states actually had a religion. Certainly, the constitution of every state, even up to this very day, all 50 of them mentioned God. But of course, we couldn't do that in the classroom, could we? Because we would corrupt and destroy our children if they knew about God, or they read the Ten Commandments, were to obey them. My goodness, what a terrible crime that would be, a wall of the separation between church and state. But certainly, none of the people who founded this country wanted to have a state religion. They did not want the federal government interfering in religion. Religion was a matter having to do with the states, and many of the states had their own religion. As time went by, they did away with specific, whether it be the Quaker religion, whether it be the Congregational religion, whether it be the Presbyterian religion. But certainly, this was left up to the states, and there was never any thought that it would be illegal for a teacher to lead a prayer, or even a non-denominational prayer. It was just that they didn't want the Catholics, they didn't want the Pope, they didn't want the Episcopalians or the Anglicans. They did not want one of the religious sects of Christianity to dominate this country. They'd seen what had happened in Europe, but taking God out of our society was like taking oxygen away from the people. There was no way they could survive without it. And didn't you have a feeling that George Washington felt that religion and morality were absolutely necessary for a free society to survive?
Oh, certainly. There's no question of it. When Washington gave his farewell address after serving two terms as president, and he knew by that time, in fact, he knew much earlier, that history would regard him as the definitive spokesman, so to speak, on what the American government, what the American experiment was all about. He was very careful in the words he chose and the speeches he gave. He knew that history would read those words carefully. And what he said in his farewell address, and now I'll quote from it, he said, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness, these firmest props of the duties of men and citizens. The mere politician, equally with the pious man, ought to respect and to cherish them. A volume could not trace all their connections with private and public felicity." And that's where that quote ends. And it's so important that he talks about private and public felicity. He did not merely believe it was good for people to pray in their homes and in their own churches, which I'm sure he thought was a good thing, but he clearly thought religion had a place in civic life, in official life, and in the role or in the realm of government.
And, of course, the question then comes up, do you believe that, of course, George Washington was a Christian? Now, many people at that time believed in God. They were called deists. They believed God had created the heavens and the earth. They didn't deny that. But then, of course, they said that he just took off and went off to another planet or went off some other place and let things run on their own. And yet, of course, the Christian really believed that God did interfere and did direct the course of mankind. Where did George Washington stand on the subject of Christianity, or do we know from his writings?
I think it's fair to say we don't know for sure. There have many books written. It's interesting. While no one yet had written a book until my co-author and I did about Washington's views of church and state in particular, there have actually been a lot of books written about George Washington's personal religious views, starting pretty shortly after he died. There was debate about that. I can tell you what we do know. It's not debated, is that he was a lifelong member of the Anglican Church. He never renounced that membership. He was baptized in the Anglican Church. He was married in the Anglican Church. He served as a vestryman in two parishes of the Anglican Church, and he was a godfather to children, you know, through the Anglican ritual. so we know that he participated in the Anglican Church. There is a theory that I find plausible, and it's not really my expertise, so that's about all I can say, but I find it plausible that when the Revolutionary War broke out, because King George III was not only the head of Great Britain, the sworn enemy of the United States, but was also the head of the Anglican Church by law in Britain, that George Washington did kind of back away from Anglicanism, not renounce his membership in the church, but he stopped attending church so frequently, was not public in his display of any support for Anglicanism, and perhaps that was because he felt a conflict with the role of the king in the church. We know also that Washington was a Freemason, and being a Freemason in that day at least, and perhaps still, requires an affirmation of some sort that you believe in a divine entity and that you believe in an afterlife. But Washington was a very private person, and one of his biographers has written that even though he was private about so many things, that among them he was most private about his religious beliefs. So there is room for some debate. I don't find persuasive those who believe he was a deist to the extent of thinking God did not play an active role in human events. It's abundantly clear, as we talked about earlier, that he thought God did play an active role in his personal life as well as in the founding of the American Republic. So he was certainly not that kind of an agnostic, is probably what I would best call it. Exactly, you know, up to the day he died, exactly what he believed is pretty hard to discern. He did at times speak in Christian terms, but he really very rarely did. He was much more prone to speak about providence, about the divine author, you know, very broad terms. And he, throughout his public career, especially in the army, in the military, he had to be mindful of having a religiously diverse, at least among Christian sects, a religiously diverse army. And he was very careful about trying not to offend even the Roman Catholics in Canada, who were an important ally. He had to deal with Quakers, who were pacifists, so when they were drafted, they refused to fight. He had to deal with the capture of British troops, and he tried very hard to let them worship according to their desires when they were in captivity. And he also was mindful that even back then, there were some Jews and some Muslims in America, and he made reference to them from time to time, giving every indication that he believed their religious rights were co-equal to the rights of anyone else.
Well, I think, of course, that the Founding Fathers really wanted a country where everybody could worship as they wanted to, but the idea that you would exclude God from our schools, from our, you know, from our courts, from our society, we're certainly beyond the belief of this could never have happened. And, of course, the only reason it has happened is somebody came along with a different agenda. knowing full well that if you wanted to destroy a great nation, why, you destroy its very foundation. And I believe the foundation of America was founded in a belief in God, and of course the predominant religion at that time was the Christian religion. And even the Supreme Court many times itself, we were a Christian nation. Not that everybody had to be a Christian, but it is the basic tenets, the ideas of Christianity, not Protestant, not Catholic, but the ideas of Christianity were the very foundation that had led the foundation of this nation. Isn't it a shame we've forgotten that lesson? Well, Joseph, certainly as you've read through the writings of Washington, and you mentioned at one point in the book that actually Washington had actually destroyed many of his original letters, as contrast to some of the other presidents, Adams, Jefferson. They seem to really, of course, want to leave all of their personal communications to posterity. Washington really didn't in many respects.
Well, I believe I'm correct about this, that the only category of correspondence that Washington sought to destroy and almost destroyed all of it was his personal correspondence with his wife, with Martha Washington, that they had agreed that they would destroy all of their letters between one another. And, of course, that would have been, while perhaps a little invasive of their personal privacy, it would have been very telling about his personal views on any number of issues, and that is lost almost entirely to history because he and Martha did succeed in destroying almost all of those letters. They literally didn't get to a few that were accidentally stuck in the back of a drawer here and there, so there are something like 3 letters that survive, and to my knowledge, none of them sheds any light on the church and state issue. But that is unfortunate in a way that there's at least a portion of his correspondence that is lost to history.
Well, you know, I think it's pretty very interesting about Washington. It said that, you know, he presided over the Constitutional Convention, and everybody else, of course, was debating the issues back and forth. Washington didn't. I mean, he just sat there. He very seldom interceded on anything. Occasionally he would vote, but he did not try to direct this. He could have certainly been the dominant force and set the tone for the Constitutional Convention. And yet, of course, he sat there presiding, but presiding silently over what happened. Did you get into that at all in your studies?
Well, we did. First, it is simply, as you describe it, it is a fact that he presided there every day, but did not, for the most part, participate in the debates. And the reason for that was that everyone, including Washington, knew that if the Constitution came to be ratified, that he would become the first president of the United States. And therefore, he felt, I think the consensus is that the reason for his lack of participation, and I think there are even notes to this effect by Madison and others as to why he wasn't more active in the convention, was that he was such an authority figure, and everyone knew in practical terms, as they were debating the powers that the president should have or shouldn't have, they were really talking about George Washington. And for him to stand up and speak in favor of not only the president having a power, but if he were to say the Congress should or should not have a power, that might have an implication for whether the president would have that same power, that it was too personal. And so he wanted to keep his distance and not appear to be coveting power. And therefore he, for the most part, there were a few exceptions, but for the most part did not speak to issues in the convention. But he certainly was, the first citizen. He was the, most admired man of his age by that point, having commanded the army that won the Revolutionary War. And he was certainly watched for every facial expression, every matter of interest he took. When he did speak, of course, he spoke with great authority. And that's something important to remember on really any issue that Washington addressed, and church and state is an important one among them, that he did not take outlying, unusual, peculiar views. He was, at the center of every event, really, that led to the creation of the American public, and his views were consistently the prevailing views, the common...
Hold that off right there, Joseph, please.
Sure.
Stand back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Joseph Smith, his book, Under God, and it's really a fascinating analysis of the views of George Washington, primarily his views as far as the importance of religion and morality based upon religion for America. And it was really, of course, this influence of the founding fathers and their dedication to God, and certainly most of them were Christians, the vast majority of them were, and some of them perhaps were deists. We really don't know quite about Benjamin Franklin, but even Benjamin Franklin believed in a God that did interfere in the affairs of men. So certainly all of them really believed that God played an important part in the formation of this country. But of course there are those who have a different agenda today, and that's the great tragedy, that today our children are raised without a knowledge of God, and you can send them to the school, 40 hours a week and do church 1 hour a week, and which do you think is going to have the dominant influence? And of course they're taught in school that there is no God, that the Bible is wrong, because of course it says that God created the heaven and earth, and everybody knows, of course, it was evolution that did that. It's just an accident of fate. And so our young people today, so many of them, of course, are completely lost, have no faith. And so where did this whole idea come about, that we would have this wall of separation? It certainly wasn't something that George Washington believed in, nor do I really believe that Thomas Jefferson really believed, that we should exclude God from our society.
Well, the phrase separation of church and state, which has become so familiar to so many Americans, first of all, we have to remind people, is not in the Constitution. That's undebatable. It's not there. Where does it come from? Thomas Jefferson. He probably didn't foresee how damaging this phrase would be to the Republic, but Thomas Jefferson in 1802, which was, interestingly, after Washington was dead, so Washington literally never even heard the phrase separation of church and state with respect to the U.S. Constitution, at least. Jefferson wrote a letter in 1802 to a group of Baptists in Connecticut saying that Jefferson's interpretation of the First Amendment, and of course Jefferson wasn't there for the debates over the First Amendment or the Constitution for that matter, but he said his interpretation was that it created a wall of separation between church and state. And that's where the phrase comes from, and you can't say Jefferson's view shouldn't be considered, but it certainly shouldn't be considered exclusively. And when you compare Jefferson's authority on the matter to Washington's, Washington was there for the Constitutional Convention. Washington was serving as president when the First Amendment was passed. Washington would, by any reasonable measure, be the better authority on it. But after Jefferson wrote that letter, I can go into more detail, but the kind of the end of the story is that's the phrase that the U.S. Supreme Court has picked up and said, that's what the First Amendment means. Well, of course, separation between church and state.
Wasn't that really, of course, in response to the fear of the ministers there, the Baptist ministers in Danbury, Connecticut, that the federal government was going to actually have some sort of a federal religion, and of course would tend to limit what they were doing. And he was saying, no, the federal government will not tell the churches what to do, rather than that the churches will not have an influence on the federal government. Wasn't that what the wall of separation was? Wasn't it a one-way wall rather than a total wall and a total barrier?
Well, it's there's a lot of context here. The Baptists in Connecticut had written a letter to Thomas Jefferson upon his election as president, which was a common practice back then, congratulating him, and they were inquiring about his views on church and state. The reason they were inquiring is the Baptists were a minority in Connecticut. In Connecticut, there was an established church. It was a Protestant but not a Baptist church. And there was a great political alliance in New England between the clergy there and the Federalist Party, Washington's party and Adams' party, Adams being the second president, Jefferson the third. Jefferson was not in their political party. He resented the influence of the New England clergy in politics. He did want to see them politically distanced, I guess, from their role in government. So the Danbury Baptists wrote to Jefferson, more or less out of their interest for feeling oppressed or potentially oppressed by the same New England clergy that they thought Jefferson to be a political adversary of.
Go right ahead. I'll tell you what.
Okay. And Jefferson wrote back. That's what gave him the opportunity, and he very carefully crafted this letter working with his attorney general. He very carefully crafted the letter and said, this is an opportunity to sow useful truths for future generations. So he announced this principle of separation of church and state. Perhaps misunderstanding what the Baptists wanted, and the history or the historical record suggests the Baptists were actually not happy with the letter. They didn't publish it, they didn't brag about it, which is what people normally did in those days. If you got a letter from the President of the United States, you publish it in your local paper. They never did that. They put it in, at least metaphorically, a dusty drawer.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with Julie Smith. Well, why don't you go right ahead and pick this story up there, Joseph?
Sure. So, we're talking about how Thomas Jefferson's separation of church and state phrase came to have such popularity. Back in 1802, when he wrote the letter that contains that phrase to the Baptists, the historical record suggests the Baptists wanted a different answer. They wanted Jefferson to say he would take a more vigorous approach and really interfere with the religious and political situation in New England, because those were his political opponents. Instead, he said, separation of church and state. The Baptists weren't very happy to hear that. So the letter went into a drawer for about 75 or so years until a case came up in the U.S. Supreme Court where a Mormon man had been prosecuted for bigamy, and his defense was based on the First Amendment to the Constitution. He said it was the free exercise of his religion to be a bigamist, and therefore there couldn't be a law under which he could be prosecuted for that. The U.S. Supreme Court, at that point, 77 or so years after Jefferson had written this letter, it having gotten nearly no attention to that point, the U.S. Supreme Court dug it out and said, well, here's what Thomas Jefferson said. There's a separation between church and state. That was the first mention of that by the U.S. Supreme Court, obviously long after all of the founders are dead, so no one was around to say you got it wrong. And even more interestingly, the U.S. Supreme Court didn't really run with the phrase at that point, but they mentioned it. And it wasn't until the middle of the 20th century, you know, another 70 years or so, that another case came before the U.S. Supreme Court, this one having to do with whether public school buses could be used to take children to parochial schools. And that's when the court went back to Thomas Jefferson's letter, said Jefferson's interpretation of the First Amendment religion clauses is that there's a separation between church and state, and this is when the U.S. Supreme Court said that is the interpretation of the First Amendment because Jefferson was the authority on it.
But of course he wasn't the authority on it.
He wasn't even there.
He had nothing to do with the First Amendment or even the writing of the Constitution. So why would they say that other than an attack on Christianity?
Well, there was doubtless a number of agendas behind the litigation that led to that decision. Jefferson was involved, very involved, in the debate over religious liberty at the time, but Jefferson was much more of a, really kind of a theoretician, almost a philosopher about these things. He's the kind of guy who would write a categorical statement, and a poetic statement for that matter, like separation of church and state. He did not have the benefit that Washington had of actually governing.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Joseph Smith, who is an author. He is actually a practicing attorney, but he and his partner another lawyer, had actually written this book called Under God. So before we go on, do you have a website that you have information on how people can get copies of your book?
Absolutely. The full title of the book is Under God, George Washington and the Question of Church and State. Those who are familiar with or prefer to buy from Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, you can get the book on either of those sites. If you want the very best price, you'll probably get that by going directly to the publisher, which is called Spence Publishing. They have a website at www.spence.publishing.com, or you can call their 800 number to the this is the publisher's 800 number is 1-888-SPENPUB, Spen Pub. You can order the book there for basically half price, and the retail price is $25. So on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, you get a discount. But you get a better discount by going to the publisher.
S-P-E-N-P-U-B, is that right?
Yes, 1-888-S-P-E-N-P-U-B.
All right, fine. Well, certainly if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment for our guest, why we'd love to hear from you. But this is a very important subject because, of course, I think what they've done is captured the very essence of George Washington. And George Washington says, you cannot have an orderly society and a moral society without religion. And we have to have that. The Supreme Court has said, we're going to take religion completely out of the public sphere at all. We're going to take it out of our schools. We're going to take it out of our courts. Or we're going to take it out of our society. And then, of course, they want to preach in their churches. It's all right, but it's not going to do any harm. But, of course, they've even held that if the Ten Commandments were posted in the schools, they wouldn't do any good if the children did not read them. If the children were to read the Ten Commandments, they might meditate upon them. If they meditated upon them, they might obey them. And that would be a violation of the wall of separation of church and state. That is the Supreme Court's decision. And why they took the Ten Commandments out of our school. And you can see the end result of that with students killing students and students killing their parents and parents killing their children. And my goodness, what happens to a nation that turns against God? And certainly, what motivated you to write the book? Were you concerned about what's happening in our society today, a society that once was a Christian society and is today, however, it really has no foundation at all in anything much other than materialism?
Well, on a personal level, I certainly was. And, you know, I have to confess to not being, I guess, probably the elder of the two of us speaking to one another, but I still grew up in America at a time when at public schools you could say a commencement prayer, you could pray before the football game, or the city, you know, hall might have a creche at Christmas time, and these things were not matters of litigation all the time and were not so controversial. So it was certainly a personal concern to me that religion was being pushed out of the public square. And that's what made it so striking for me when I was really not a related purpose, but just by chance, reading Washington's writings. And you read his speeches, you read his first inaugural address. So he's being sworn in as the first president of the United States. He knows how important these words are. And the first thing he says is that it would be conspicuously wrong for him not to make his first official act, so not a personal act, his first official act, it would be wrong for him not to make that act to praise God and thank him for his role in the creation of the American Republic. And I thought, my goodness, if George Washington, of all people, could say something like that, yet, you know, these days the football captain can't say a prayer for victory before the game, something has gone wrong.
Something certainly has gone wrong, that's for certain. Go right ahead.
Well, just saying, so that's what led me to look into it. There was an element of personal concern. You know, I certainly would say my personal concern did not preordain the result I was going to reach, but I was, you know, struck by the historical record. And when you read it, that's one reason my co-author and I have included in the book a very generous sampling of Washington. In his own words, wherever we could, we included the entirety of a speech or the entirety of a letter so that people wouldn't feel they were getting a very selective presentation because there's no better way to judge this issue than to read Washington in his own words and not, you know, not take our word for it. But, of course, we try in the first half of the book to provide a narrative that leads the reader through it so you don't just have to plod through a bunch of speeches and military orders and correspondence.
But, of course, so often in the military orders and correspondence, why the subject of God was raised?
Absolutely. I mean, Washington frequently commanded his troops to attend divine services. The issue of the chaplains came up again and again, not just getting public funding for the chaplains, which he believed very strongly in, but also providing more chaplains at the lower levels of the military as opposed to, you know, the brigade level or whatever, so that more individual soldiers were more likely to have a chaplain of their own religion. And he was really taking care to allow people to practice their own religion. He was not, you know, going about forcing people to practice other religions, but he wanted there to be no doubt in the military that you needed to be praying and you needed to be respectful and worshiping of God.
And I think it was so interesting that he was very much against swearing and take the Lord's name in vain by his soldiers. And weren't they actually punished if they were found to be swearing and taking the Lord's name in vain?
Well, they were, and early in his military career, he was embarrassed by some public reports of his soldiers being kind of out of control and swearing and his not running a very orderly military. And that was one occasion on which he really snapped too. And so we're going to change this. And the primary, way in which he went about that was to command more religious observance by the troops.
And I think that certainly Washington recognized the fact that we were never going to be able to have a society, this wonderful experiment in creating this new organization, this new society, this new way of life, without, of course, a religious foundation for it. And now, of course, we see what happens to a nation that turns against God. Well, our telephone number is, of course, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I would simply caution our listeners. Of course, you see George Barner doing all these polls that say the majority of our people are Christians. Well, the majority believe in God. Well, that doesn't mean that they believe in the same God that you and I do. There is many, many people out there who are deeply spiritual, but of course it has nothing to do with Christianity or the conventional religions of America, because we had the Catholic religion, we had the Protestant religion, we had the Baptist religion, we had the Congregationalists, we had the Methodists, we had the Quakers, we had the Huguenots. And somebody wanted me to repeat the name of the book. And, of course, why don't you give the name of the book here?
The full title of the book is Under God, George Washington and the Question of Church and State.
Under God, George Washington and the Question of Church and State. So if anybody, you didn't get that, well, you can always give us a call at our 800 number and we'll get it for you. But it's really Under God, George Washington and the Question of Separation of Church and State. And this is really what's so important, because, of course, the Supreme Court set out, in my estimation, to destroy the religious foundation of this nation. We had people on the Supreme Court who had a different worldview. And there are people who have a different worldview. They have a right to that, to free society. But they do not have a right to get into our courts and change the very fabric of our society. Five men transformed America in these religious decisions, and unfortunately have led to where we are today. Well, we've got Tom calling from Michigan. Tom, do you have a question for our guest?
Regarding the Constitution and everything, but one thing before I get on thing, the first president of the United States was actually Jonathan Hanson.
Well, of course,
the Constitution was George Washington.
I see. All right. But, you're talking about, of course, the article. You're talking about the Articles of Confederation.
Yeah, the first.
All right, fine.
Jonathan Hanson.
All right, fine. Do you have a question at all?
Yes, I was wondering, what does he think about, Benjamin Franklin saying, he'd lived many years and, when he asked for prayer for the, the constitutional debates?
I've lived a long time, sir, and the longer I live, the more convinced I am that God rules in the affairs of men. Yes, that's a wonderful statement. But, of course, I don't know whether Joseph's an expert on Benjamin Franklin. He certainly is an expert on George Washington, but I appreciate
George was in charge of the convention.
All right, fine. Thank you. George Washington was in charge of the convention.
Yeah, and Ben Franklin, said that. And
what do you think about that, Joseph?
I am not certainly a Franklin biographer, but I think it's unsurprising. It was a very conventional, common view at the time. These simple, to many of us obvious statements of the existence of God or God's affair in the roles or God's role in the affairs of men were not controversial at the time. Probably the most controversial of the founders in terms of religion was Jefferson. He had a very peculiar, very personal view of his own Christianity. He declared himself a Christian, but really almost a religion of one, and he had a very strange project trying to kind of reorganize and dissect the Bible into the way he thought it should be. That's obviously a very peculiar way of going about it, not that he didn't have the right to do it, but I think for the most part, the founders were very conventional believers in God, most of them from, the Protestant sects. There's an argument to be made that some of them were more deist, perhaps an actively Christian, but, you know, the someone declaring that the older he got, the more he was convinced that God played a role in the affairs of men, I think people would nod off sleeping in that day. That wasn't a provocative statement. That was kind of stating the obvious.
Right. And I think that even Thomas Jefferson, as he grew older, his views changed a great deal. We have a wonderful book actually put out by the lawyers in New York back in 1907, called The Master Thoughts of Thomas Jefferson, where he talks about how, as he got older, of course, he began, changing a lot of his views and decided not even to worry about a lot of these things, just to lay his head on this soft pillow that Christ had prepared for him. So you begin to see many of his views, I think, altering as he grows older. And I think certainly all of these men altered their views. So many of them, I think Adams' views changed. I think that Washington's views changed from when he was a boy to those views he held as a man. And of course, we really don't know too much about exactly what he believed, because it was always very, very personal. But time and time and again, I think you bring it out so well in your book, that George Washington talked about the necessity of a belief in God if we were going to have a moral society. And without religion, there could be no stable society.
There is no question that he believed that. And in fact, I found in reviewing, you know, everything that Washington ever wrote or said that had anything to do with religion, not to mention a ton of material beyond that, that the amazing thing to me was you come away from the historical record without the view that Washington was a personal, you know, religious zealot, allowing his own personal religious views to spill into public life. It was almost the opposite with him. You know, whatever he thought personally about God and about religion, he was pretty restrained in it. In his correspondence, we talked earlier about how his correspondence with Martha no longer exists for the most part, but in his other personal correspondence, his private correspondence, he was actually less religious than he was in his public speeches, in his public military orders, in his public correspondence. He seemed to think that there was a special duty for the public office holder to be conspicuously religious, to bring religion, to make sure there was no doubt that there would be religion in civic life, because that was part of the job, almost regardless of whether what you thought personally. So it's almost more instructive that Washington was not the most religiously fervent man on earth, who just happened to be letting that get into his role as the president or commander of the military, whatever it might be. He was pretty restrained in his private religiosity, less restrained when it came to public action.
And I think that's really a very, very important part, but a very, very important point about if he recognized that the importance of religion in the maintenance of a stable society.
His key conclusion, I guess, or maybe even premise for government action, was believing that free people needed to be virtuous and moral in order to govern themselves, and in order to be virtuous and moral, they absolutely had to have religion. So government had an interest in promoting religion.
And, of course, if you destroy, in my estimation, the religion of a nation, you would destroy the ability of the people to remain free. And I think it was John Adams had made a remark about our form of government was made for a moral and religious people. It would not work for any others. And the reason was you couldn't have limited government if you didn't have moral restraints on the part of the people. And if people couldn't restrain themselves, then government would have to restrain them. Would that be a fair analysis?
I think that's fair, and it is also fair to say that Adams and Washington were generally in line with one another on this issue, and that even Jefferson, as I said earlier, I don't think Jefferson had any idea of the Pandora's box he was opening by penning this phrase, separation of church and state, because even Jefferson later said that Washington was absolutely right, that religion was an indispensable support in a democratic society.
And I certainly concur with that. Well, we've got about 3 minutes here for to wrap up some ideas. If you're out there in the telephone audience, give us a call of 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But all of these issues are so vitally important because America, I believe, is on the is at a crossroads now. And if this country doesn't turn back to the religious foundation upon which our freedom is based, then freedom will soon become simply a remembrance of things past. Well, Sidney, what sort of response have you had? You must have talked to a lot of people on a lot of radio stations about your book. I know Spence Publishing does a good job of getting the information out. What sort of response have you gotten?
It's been an intriguing response because I think, as strange as this is, it's a topic that people haven't really focused on before. I mean, here we have the first president of the United States, the most authoritative man on the Constitution, on a very, very important issue that people had never thought about before. So I think, like you had a caller call in, there's been a lot of curiosity about the issue, a lot of good questions from those who practice law in the area, including several judges, had a really, really positive response saying, you know, come to think of it, this is a really important piece of history, and I don't know. No one can quite put their finger on why no one until now decided to really address this issue.
Well, I'm glad that you and your friend did address the issue. What's the name of your co-author?
The co-author is Tara Roth.
Tara Roth.
She lives in Texas, and she's also a lawyer.
All right, fine. Well, we certainly won't hold that against her at all. There are a lot of good lawyers out there. Ladies and gentlemen, we have to understand that it's the people involved in the law profession who've got us into this mess we're in, and who knows, maybe it'll be some of the lawyers, like Mr. Smith and Tara Roth, who will help us to get out of this situation. Because a nation without divine guidance will soon no longer be a free nation. Hang on there, Joseph, for just a moment. We'll let you go. Well, we've got 3 minutes now for you to sort of wrap up the program. And what thoughts would you like to leave with our listeners all across America?
Well, I think the key lesson of looking back at George Washington's views on church and state is that people shouldn't take for granted and shouldn't just accept this idea that the Constitution requires a strict separation of church and state. And it's not just a matter of personal opinion. It is an effort to discern the original meaning of the Constitution. And if we're going to be a society that's governed by the rule of law instead of the rule of men, we need to figure out, you know, what the laws, and including the Constitution, actually mean and fairly apply them.
Well, it sounds like you're an originalist.
I certainly am.
In fact, I saw a Justice Scalia there over the weekend on 60 Minutes, and he was accused of being an originalist. And I really wish he'd come back with something better than that, defending a dead Constitution instead of believing in a living Constitution. I wish he'd come back and said, no, I believe in what the law is that I've sworn to uphold, and the law is the Constitution. But to allow himself to be labeled as an originalist, I mean, Sidney, you're an originalist, I'm an originalist, but that's a terrible phrase. It's like being called a detractor, or, you know, or somebody who doesn't believe in the a denier, I think is the term they use for the people who don't believe in the Holocaust, denier. And you're an originalist. That really would be a great tribute. I believe in the Constitution as it was written. I believe in the laws of this land. What about these people who've sworn to uphold the Constitution and are there to destroy it?
Well, that's, you know, and you have to ask yourself, why does the Constitution have an amendment procedure if it's just up to judges to make it flexible over time?
Right.
The point is, we do have a way to change the Constitution if we don't like it, but that is to amend it.
And, of course, how much easier it is simply to get people onto the Supreme Court and for whatever reason to get them to vote the way that you want, and that way five people can rule a nation of 300 million very, very readily. All they have to do is say, this is the law. And yet that was never, of course, what our founders wanted. And the purpose of the Supreme Court was to interpret the Constitution, having nothing to do with what you believed.
Right. And there are few examples where that is more of a problem today than in the area of church and state.
Amen to that. Well, I want to really thank you so very much for what you've done. We probably won't be talking to you again until you write your next book. Have you thought about that?
We've been encouraged to write more or less the same type of book about John Adams, and that's not out of the question.
All right, fine. Well, either that, I think that would be a fascinating, fascinating subject, or even Benjamin Franklin, for that matter. We need to go back to the original writings, the original speeches, to really find out what these men believed. Joseph, thank you very much for being patient enough to be on all of our programs, and God bless you.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, nobody ever asked the question, why did the Supreme Court take God and prayer out of our schools? And the answer is really very, very simple, but nobody will ever tell you. And the reason they did it is because members of a secret society took control of our United States Supreme Court in 1941, and by majorities of 5-4 to 8-1 between 1941 and 1971, they ripped the very heart out of this nation. Of course, these were the Masons, and they were put there by 32nd degree Mason Franklin Delano Roosevelt and 33rd degree Mason Harry Truman. And the purpose of Masonry has always been to change America from being a Christian nation to a secular nation. And then, of course, to merge it into this one world government that the founders of the ancient mystery religions had wanted. And, of course, modern-day Masonry is simply a manifestation of the ancient mystery religions and Gnosticism. And, of course, if you want more information on that, certainly my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, covers that. But you can learn it from Paul Fisher's excellent book, which we carry, Behind the Lodge Door. That's Behind the Lodge Door. Or James Wardner, Dr. James Wardner's excellent book, Unholy Alliance. We have the world's last supply of those books, and when they're gone, why, they're going to be gone. And I think he goes into great detail about the influence of Masonry at every aspect of our society. And, of course, they have a temple back in Washington, D.C. They have the statue of Albert Pike, who was one of the founders of the Ku Klux Klan back in Washington, D.C. And where is the NAACP when you really need them? Why aren't they out there demonstrating and demanding that that statue be torn down? A Confederate general who was actually an organizer of the Ku Klux Klan. But, of course, we have to understand how powerful these people are and how Masonry interlocks with the rest of the Brotherhood of Darkness. And you must understand that we have all sorts of organizations out there founded in the occult that believes in a different God. And when you understand that, it all begins to make sense. We have three pamphlets here, very important, to call The Occult Hierarchy. It deals with the occult hierarchy that rules America, and you've never even heard of them. Of course, we go into more detail in my talk on the planned police state, and we actually give you some of their publications where they talk about the work of the spiritual hierarchy. And they really know exactly what they're doing because they're in touch with people from the other dimension. And there is a supernatural dimension out there. If you're a Christian, you have to believe in the supernatural, but understand that it is not simply angels that are there, but demons as well. And so we hope that you'll want to get my talk on the planned police state, and be sure to get the syllabus that goes with that. Get our talk on the secret knowledge. I'm sorry, the forbidden secret, syllabus that goes with that. You have to understand the supernatural element of what's going on in our society today. And if I could suggest our four-tape set, it's called The Supernatural, interviews with Joanna Michelson and interviews with Craig Heimbichner. The book that goes along with that is called The Beautiful Side of Evil. We recommend it to you because Joanna Michelson was a medium. Incidentally, she will be a guest at our conference that we're having on the 26th of April, and we do hope many of you have marked that off, and you'll come from across America to hear Joanna, and, of course, Dr. Russell Blaylock and the other people who will be with us on that date. We do hope, of course, that you'll tell others about our program and encourage them to come to our conference on the 26th of October. If you want to understand how this ties into what's really going on today, why, of course, you need to get the book, The Satanic Crimes, because it goes into the Bilderbergers. The Bilderbergers is one of the groups that rules the world today. And, of course, Satanic Crimes deals with the interlock between the Bilderbergers and, of course, these satanic ritual crimes that they've been involved in. That's Satanic Crimes. The book, the four-tape set, understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Because America is at war today, please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5.